That was the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time. Reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world.
...1926, that was the year. Kings Bay, Amsterdam Island, Spitsbergen, May 9, 1926. 50 minutes after midnight, a carefully tested Fokker monoplane equipped with three Wright air-cooled motors crouches in the Arctic half-light of early summer, poised for flight. Two men, heavily swathed in fur parkas, sit at the controls and instruments.
Ready, Floyd?
Sure.
Shall I take her off, Dick?
Go ahead.
Accompanied only by his pilot, Floyd Bennett, Lieutenant Commander Richard Evelyn Byrd begins his historic journey. Flying in a straight line, Byrd and Bennett reach their destination, circle the North Pole several times, begin the return trip, after verifying Admiral Peary's observations made in 1909. The intrepid explorers reach their starting point at 4:20 p.m., after covering a distance of 1,600 miles in 15 and a half hours. May 11, 1926. 2 days after the flight of Byrd and Bennett, Norseman Roald Amundsen begins his flight to the North Pole. In the semi-rigid Italian dirigible Norge, accompanied by U.S. citizen Lincoln Ellsworth and crew, Amundsen also reaches the pole, circles it twice, heads across the unexplored Arctic basin to Point Barrow, Alaska, landing finally at Tella on the Bering Sea. The Norge had covered a distance of 2,700 miles in only 71 hours. In 5 days, two dynamic chapters in the history of aerial exploration begun and concluded.
1926. That was the year.
At about 3:30 on the afternoon of July 10, one of hundreds of gay, joyous weekending parties drive along a highway in upper central New Jersey.
Say, folks, I think it's going to rain.
Oh, no.
Well, look at those clouds over there.
Yep, I think he's right. If those aren't thunderclouds, I'll eat them.
You think we ought to turn back?
Oh, gee, it's been swell all week, and now...
Listen.
There it is. It's right on us. Boy, that storm's moving plenty fast.
Well, I think this is just awful.
Well, never mind, honey. We can go back and have our feet in your living room. Your folks won't care.
Well, here I go.
That wasn't thunder.
Look! A great big ball of fire shooting straight up.
Elsie, where are you?
Here I am. Here.
Are you all right?
I guess so.
Look out!
What is it? What's the matter?
Lie flat on your faces. Crawl for that ditch over there. I know what it is. It's that Navy ammunition depot at Dover. It's been struck by lightning.
In three successive blasts, the great stores of ammunition at the Lake Denmark Arsenal in Dover transformed the tranquil New Jersey countryside into a holocaust of screaming shrapnel, spewing man-made death for a distance of more than 6 miles, throwing men and women and children into hysterical terror. When the din had ceased, 30 had been killed, hundreds had been injured, and hundreds more had been made homeless. After inspecting the $93 million damage, said Brigadier General U.A. Drum,
"It looks exactly like the Western Front."
1926. That was the year.
New York City, August 24 at 10 a.m. The last sacrament was said for the world's greatest screen lover, Rudolph Valentino. At 10 minutes past high noon, death stole his life while the actor lay in the peace of coma. That afternoon, his body was removed to lie in state in the funeral church at the corner of Broadway and 66th. By 8 p.m., an emergency hospital had been established back of the funeral parlors for the treatment of hundreds who had been mauled and trampled in the rioting mob, fighting for a chance to view for the last time the mortal body of the hero of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse and the Sheik. At 11 p.m., a squad of 10 men attired completely in black entered the church to stand guard. At midnight, said Valentino's manager,
"This has gone far enough. From now on, Valentino's body will be viewed only by friends and associates under my personal supervision. The lack of reverence shown by the crowd, the disorder and rioting since the body was first shown, have forced me to this decision."
Thus was an emotional, hectic, noisy tribute paid to Valentino. From Hollywood, the screen's number one portrayer of vampire roles, Paola Negri, spoke.
"Since he spent so many hours, his happiest hours, here, and because I am here, I want him buried in Hollywood. But if his brother should wish him buried in Italy, to lie beside his father and mother, that is different. I can understand that."
Within the cloistered walls of a Southern California mausoleum, surrounded by sculptures and marble panels from his native land, Rudolph Valentino's body was laid away, 3,000 miles from the seething mob of 66th and Broadway.
1926, that was the year.
Rome, Italy, September 11. The automobile bearing Premier Benito Mussolini toward his office is hailed by a smiling, shouting, milling crowd of fascist Italians. Suddenly, a bomb hurtles through the air, hits the window of the official car, falls into the street, explodes, and injures 8 persons. Mussolini, his grim jaw set in determination, addresses the crowd.
"My people, I am all right. I am not hurt. What I say to you, this kind of thing must end. Excessive and culpable tolerance of plotters beyond our frontiers cannot any longer be endured. When I speak, it is to announce my policies, which will be pushed through with characteristic fascist determination and method."
But the fascist determination and method did not prevent another attempt against his life, the third in 1926. On October 31, while returning from the inauguration of the Scientific Congress of Bologna, Mussolini heard a shot, whirled to face an 18-year-old youth holding a smoking small-caliber pistol. Before the intended assassin could fire again, the mob fell upon him, stabbed him 14 times, finished the job by strangulation. On December 15, a new law appeared in Italy, providing for the dissolution of anti-fascist organizations, the suppression of seditious newspapers, the revival of the death sentence for attempts upon the lives of the king, the queen, the crown prince, or the premier.
1926, that was the year.
Had England experienced one of her most serious crises in modern history, the general strike of 1926. A situation of extreme gravity, which had its inception in the coal industry, grew rapidly to other fields. Fundamentally, the issue between miners and mine owners was this. The owners,
because of the immense loss of markets during the World War, which, by the by, threatens to be permanent, and because of the rising costs of labor and transportation, the mining industry is not paying its way.
The worker,
the trouble with the old thing is somewhat like this. There's too many mines. The struggle of small, poor miners against the selfishness of the big uns is an abomination, and we demand nationalization of the industry.
And while actual armed conflict threatened to break out periodically, the great Liberal Party of England saw itself torn asunder by differences between its two leaders, David Lloyd George and Herbert Henry Asquith, Earl of Oxford and Asquith. With the knowledge that his resignation from active participation in affairs of the Liberal Party might help to solve England's internal strife, might weld the two opposing elements into renewed unity, Asquith, now 74 years of age, made his final speech.
"And so I am leaving the party with which I have been identified throughout my life. Let none of you, and especially none of the younger among you, be content to think the mission of liberalism is exhausted. The new problems which confront us, and they are many and grave, are not outside the ambition of the old faith. Keep that faith. carry on the torch, which we, who have done our best to keep it alight, hand over to your custody. Resist all allurements of shortcuts and compromise. Look neither to the right nor the left, but keep straight on.
1926, that was the year.
And a motion picture adaptation of a thrilling stage success featured Edmund Lowe and Victor McLaglen in the hilarious roles of Captain Flagg and Sergeant Quirt. At the orchestral score of What Price Glory featured a song dedicated to the winsome heroine played by Dolores del Rio, Charmaine.
My heart keeps calling.